Good morning and welcome to the first hour of Focus 580. My name is Rita Schulte, sitting in for David Inge, your regular host. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and today at the controls are Jason Croft and Henry Frain. I'd like you to think back for a moment to the last time you were in a public place and just sat and listened to the conversations around you. Generally speaking, this might be considered a little bit rude, but if you did it, you might have noticed that very few English teachers would have been completely pleased with what you heard. And yet, there may have been business transactions, family reunions, and all kinds of matters of human relations being conducted, and the medium was language. My guest this morning is Barbara Walrath, senior editor of the Back Page of Word Court and Word Fugitives columnist for The Atlantic. Welcome.
Thank you, Rita. Glad to be here.
Oh, and this is going to be fun. I've looked forward to this for weeks, and this was one of the things that one of the subjects that I think is just endlessly fascinating, because people have a real passion for what's the right word for this is the question. Everybody, you can see it in some people's eyes when they're talking even.
Well, your introduction, if I can, led me off in a slightly different direction, mm-hmm. because a year ago I was taking a class in fiction writing,
ooh,
something new for me, and our assignment every single week was to go be in a public place, sit down as close as we could to strangers, and write down the things they said. It was fascinating because, I mean, you're quite right. Nobody ever speaks grammatically. And the ways in which they're ungrammatical in conversation sometimes make all the difference to how clear they are.
It makes
who they are mm-hmm. clearer because of the way they talk outside the rules.
And one of the things that I noticed on we were watching television the other night, and there was this commercial where there was a family, and the mom was complaining about the text messaging bill. And she was speaking English, and everybody else was firing back text language. And it sort of made me remember a passage that you had in, it was either Word Count or Word Fugitives, about Chaucer. And I was reading Chaucer, the Chaucer piece, and thinking, you know, I don't understand Chaucer any better than I understand my 20-year-olds when they're like, I'm in a lot of trouble here. Because not only being on the Word Fugitive 10 Most Wanted list as a personal abuser of the English language, probably, I'm not doing really well with the old school or with the new evolution. It's sort of an interesting experience.
Well, now we're just having a conversation, mm-hmm. so I'm not going to correct your grammar, and you won't correct mine, okay? We just won't go there.
No, it wouldn't be a good thing for me, I'm sure. I'd like to invite our audience into the conversation. The phone number is 333-9455, or if you're calling long distance, it's 800-222-9455. And one of the things that I was really impressed by was a news story a while ago about French. It was on, I think, the News Hour on public broadcasting. And there was this board of people who were evaluating languages for admission into the language. And I thought, that's really odd. And then I found out that happens to English, too.
No, it does not.
Doesn't it? Is it so that panel that belongs to the American Heritage Dictionary isn't making a qualitative judgment on things? That is happening, is it not, when things are added to dictionaries?
And I'm a member of the American Heritage mm-hmm. Dictionary usage panel, but the Académie Française has, for some reason that I don't quite understand, an actual official say over what is properly French and what isn't. Mm-hmm. And you may be able to get away with that with French people in France. this is the United States. We're mm-hmm. the land of the free. And we get to talk however we want. Mm-hmm. I just don't think you could do that. You can mm-hmm. say to people in standard English that is understood by educated speakers from coast to coast, this is good English and that is not.
Mm-hmm.
And you can decide whether you want to use the not good English or when you want to. I think it's really useful to think about language as being kind of like clothes. The way you express who you are with clothes, except, of course, that clothes are to keep you warm and to keep you decent, and the entire purpose of language is communication.
Right.
But there, I mean, you would wear one thing to an evening wedding, and you would wear something else to an afternoon barbecue. And to say, well, this or that is incorrect, it just depends on the setting. It depends on the context. I don't think there is such a thing as being incorrect in a conversation with your friends if they understand what you're talking about.
There is that. One of the most enjoyable features of the best time I had was going through the two books that you published and all of the very strong opinions people do have about language. I guess I spent most of my life sort of stumbling through thinking, you know, Sister Chrysantha cared a lot and probably would have been happy to have sat on that board in France to tell me that, no, this is the way you always speak. It would come as a shock to her that she couldn't do that. But I was impressed just in researching and looking around how much passion the use of language has and the incorrect word and the correct word has for some people. That this is it's not something to be taken for granted.
Well, and when people say, oh, who cares, I would just like to pull out of my files letters and say, these people care. These people care a lot. They get into arguments. They send me letters where they've bet, I wouldn't say huge sums of money, but bet money on, is this right or is this wrong? The arguments among coworkers, my boss really bugs me, I think she's wrong, but people care, and not just in an academic way.
Right. We have a caller from Westfield who would like to join in on the conversation. Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning.
Do you have a question or a comment?
Well, I have a comment, and really I'd like a little discussion on this. That there are a few words that are used, a few words and expressions that are used all the time now, and I get tired of hearing them. One is utilization for use. You can the word can be. I'm not sure why they got used to saying utilization and cast out use.
I can explain what the word was intended for.
Well, yes, go ahead.
There's a vague little shade of meaning that utilize is supposed to have, and I agree with you completely. People seem to have forgotten that the words aren't just synonymous. So utilize is a complicated way of saying use, and it really, why add complication? So I'm with you. Utilize is used way too much. But the idea was to put something to use that possibly wasn't intended for that purpose. And I think the examples given in the American Heritage Dictionary are, I don't know how to use this computer, kind of suggests you're sitting down, you barely know how to turn it on, you don't know what to do with the keys. But if you say, I don't know how to utilize this computer, it might mean that you already have another computer and you don't know what you can do with it.
I think the people using that, using utilization, are not, they're just substituting utilization for use.
Oh, I agree with you completely, and I think you and I should both say, oh, you mean you don't know how to turn that to a useful purpose? And when they look baffled, then we'll say, well, actually, the shade of meaning for utilize is a little different.
Another thing is, you know, we've got away from and we've complicated it by saying, you know, and if I already know, don't bother telling me again.
Oh, now that was a complaint my father used to make about speech. Almost 50 years ago, people have been saying, you know, for a long time. There are a lot of these fillers, like, and I know if you and I continued to talk, we would get around to the way people use like at some point. It's like annoying when, you know, people like do this. So their people's speech isn't quite, and their thought processes aren't running quite in sync, so they want to throw something in while they're thinking of the next thing to say. You know is one of them.
I find the people that are hired as commentators and as news reporters on television and on radio use it all the time. Basically, it is that they have not prepared their presentation well enough to know what to do next.
I am with you that people who are, in effect, paid to talk should talk pretty well. And if a commentator sounds inarticulate or just doesn't, that's not right. But what I'm trying to say is, in casual conversation, if people you're talking to say you know a lot, I would urge you to be forgiving.
You have to be. Right.
Yes. Yes.
The people will tell you to write the way you speak, but people do not write the way they speak.
They definitely
go into a more formal way of communicating when they pick up the pen.
I think you want to write the way you wish you spoke. Or that's me, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Hey, this is going to be a real good program. I'm glad you got it on.
Well, I'm glad you're enjoying it, and I hope we can encourage some other listeners to call us at 333-9455 or toll-free 800-222-9455 and join the conversation with our guest this morning, Barbara Walrup, senior editor of the back page of Word Court and the Word Fugitives column for The Atlantic. We have a caller on line number one from Urbana. Welcome.
Hello. I had a couple things I was wondering if your guest might address. I'm a linguist, first of all, so I, instead of being critical of how people use words, I tend to find it interesting how the meaning of words evolves over time. The first thing I wanted to talk about was the plural of process, which seems to have changed from processes when I was younger to, I heard a lot of people say processes, which I think is probably related to plurals like analyses. And the other one was the expression no troubles, which I hadn't really heard until a couple years ago, and I was wondering if you know if that is related to the expression Hakuna Matata from Swahili that's used in The Lion King.
I don't know that offhand. My suspicion is no troubles is related to no worries, which is the Australian or was the Australian equivalent of no problem.
That could... Is it the sort of thing that might possibly have slipped in through movies where people are exposed to more interesting or what appears to be more interesting ways of expressing something? I mean, Crocodile Dundee brought no worries into our realm in America, probably, unless you happen to, if it's a real expression in Australia, never having been there, maybe known someone from Australia. But I think that the caller brings up an interesting point at how quickly pieces of phrasing from movies become part of our daily vocabulary. It's almost viral. Clint Eastwood was good for some of those things that were unfortunate if you had little boys that you were trying to raise. Bart Simpson was another. So I always thought it was interesting how viral some of those phrases could be and how quickly they moved through the language.
I need to go back and read Richard Dawkins's book called It's about meme theory. Well, if you look on Amazon for Richard Dawkins, you'll find it. But the idea of the meme as being almost genetic, but the idea is that ideas are like viruses, that they are contagious. A word example I can think of is Y2K.
Oh, yeah.
Until around some point in, I think, 1999 or maybe late 1998, you just didn't know how to refer to the change of century, change of millennium. And then all of a sudden, and I believe it came from the computer world with the Y2K problem. Oh, my goodness, we've mm-hmm. only got two digits and we actually need three or four. Suddenly, the new year became Y2K. And everybody started saying it. It seemed like it took about 2 weeks for everybody
right.
in America to hear about that.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And then, of course, that the Y2K problem didn't materialize. It was the year 2000. We all forgot about it. And by the way, we still don't have a name for the current decade. People have been asking me that for
really?
More than a decade, since way before 1997. Gee, when 2000 comes around, what are we going to call? And I actually looked back in history to see what 1900 to 1910 was called, to see if there was a precedent for that. Not particularly. We didn't start making a big deal out of decades. Oh, the 50s were like this, the 60s were like that, until relatively recently.
Hmm.
So were the aughts? Were the there are a lot of things have been proposed, but nothing has really caught on. And it's an interesting point about language that words that you actually want just don't turn up.
That's rude.
Well, and they've been missing for, could we please have a gender-neutral pronoun for he or she?
Oh, that's a scary one. There's a lot of conversation about that, I bet.
Yeah, and I had lunch with a couple of British dictionary editors. It must have been 10 years ago, and they said, well, we use they. It's perfectly standard in England. It's just what we do.
Hmm.
America just isn't ready for that. And I could argue it either way. Once
uh-huh.
you start with singular and plural being quite as, just as hard to tell apart as they would be if they could be one person or a bunch of them,
mm-hmm.
It adds confusion. On the other hand, did you know that the word you used to be plural only?
No.
Way, way, way back when. One you was the or
mm-hmm.
thou, and several of you were you. And then, as has happened in other languages, somehow the plural turned into a sort of more formal singular, like you'd refer to one person above you on the social scale as you. And then it just became polite to call anybody you, and there went the and thou.
Huh. So the and thou has sort of become segregated into church language almost. You hear it there and in a few other rare places, but very seldom do I hear it in regular on-the-street conversation.
Yeah, I think you would even find it is listed as archaic or something
mm-hmm.
in the dictionary. It's just not not the way we say it anymore.
It seems like we have a great deal of difficulty referring to people in the not by name. I have a cousin, in fact, came from the South, and it was y'all and all y'all, and I'm thinking, well, that was an interesting way of dealing with the problem, but it got the point across when she was a child. Now, not so much. Law courts don't like that very much. You don't really always know, even in written language, how often do you re-mention a name so that people know who the he or she is you're referring to, because you can get yourself into a real Gordian knot with pronouns. And you don't know who you're talking about anymore if you're not careful.
Well, I used to be a very close line editor of
mm-hmm.
every word that went into the Atlantic Monthly, and I did that for, I think, 17 or 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
never found a situation where it was impossible to straighten things out so you didn't have one of these hideous he or she in his or her own mind feels that he or she, it was never, you could always straighten it out. And the rules for where you put the person's name back in are very subjective, but they're not, there are rules for that that make sense. Mm-hmm. Just if somebody's the subject of a sentence and then somebody else is the object in the same sentence, with the pronouns, you have to keep that same relationship. George, boy, let's construct a sentence with two people in it. Maybe not George Bush. Help me.
Oh, okay. Maybe Michael Jordan took Mary Smith to the press box, and they spoke. They did an interview. They conducted an interview.
Okay, well, that's really easy because he's he and she.
She. Okay, so maybe it's another player. Tom Jones. Michael Jordan and Tom Jones went to the press box for an interview when he was visiting at the University of Illinois.
Yeah, and there you go. That's exactly an example, because either one of them could be he. There's just no hint whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
People think that the name that's the closest to the pronoun is supposed to be the one that the pronoun refers to, but it's in practice, having seen a zillion sentences on the page, it's not the case. It's the closest one that's in the same position in a sentence.
Right.
So that if you said, I have to admit, I am not. Tom Jones is another player, did you say?
No, it's just a name I kind of made up.
Yeah, I kind of thought he was a musician, but anyway. Michael Jordan met Tom Jones for a drink.
Mm-hmm.
He told him that he enjoyed his work very much. That ought to be, and I think fairly plainly, is Michael Jordan telling Tom Jones how much he enjoys his, Tom Jones's work.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree with that?
I would say so.
Yeah. And that's just because the subject of one sentence remains the subject of the next sentence. And if you start saying, well, the closest pronoun ought to be the one that you get all messed up.
Mm-hmm.
I hear a lot of, one of the things that keeps my word court column in business is people have been taught things, and if any teachers are listening, I'm not saying teachers don't get it right. People sometimes think they were taught something 30 years ago that if you went back and found that teacher, the teacher would say, no, that isn't what I meant. That isn't even what I said. But people get these ideas that all kinds of real-life evidence can contradict. They can hear really well-spoken people say it some other way, and they'll just keep thinking, oh, that's wrong. So they'll write me a letter saying, couldn't you please tell everybody in the world to stop saying, And it is then my job to say, well, actually, there's nothing wrong with that.
Oh.
It's a difficult position for me to be in, because I do like to think I know all of the niceties, all of the this is a mess, but any firm ban on splitting infinitives, for instance,
no.
I mean, I don't like to boldly go. I don't like the way that sounds. I would say to go boldly.
Mm-hmm.
But there are places in sentences where you just have to put something between the to and the go, the to and the rest of the word. You have to put the adverb in there, or else you're just not going to know what the adverb refers to.
Right. I want to pass along the phone number one more time to our listeners. It's 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. 9455. My guest this morning is Barbara Walriff, senior editor of the back page of Word Court and the Word Fugitives columnist for The Atlantic. And one of the things that I was sort of curious about is there a controversy that is just, I know in everyday life there's always something that pops up that just tickles you. That, you know, it kind of came out of the blue and the writer was so clever or the person who brought the question was so clever and the question is just, you started picking at it and you go, yes, this is really kind of odd or funny or strange. Have you ever had sort of a judgment that you made that just tickles you to think back on it? that you can say on the radio.
Well, there's an Elvis Presley song running through my head.
Oh, that's not a bad thing.
I can't. I'm trying. The thing is, I'm trying to remember what it applies to.
What's the Elvis Presley song?
Well, the song or the verse starts, "Wise men say."
Oh.
Wise men say.
Ooh, in the meantime, while you're thinking about that, we've got somebody on a cell phone on I-55, and they're working hard to get to us. So we're going to put that caller on the air with his question or her question. Hello.
Hello.
Yes. And your question is? Hello?
Are you there?
Yes. Can you hear us? Oh, we got a little bit of a challenge. Okay, can you hear us now?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. I'm sorry about that. What was your question or comment?
I'd love to hear you speak of words like disenfranchised. You know, I've often heard that word being used, but I've never heard anybody being enfranchised, and I've never heard of anyone being gruntled as the thing from disgruntled. I'd love to hear you speak of that.
Well, that's
all
fun.
Right. There are... I'm... As we just discovered with the Elvis Presley song, I'm not really good at coming up with examples out of my brain. But there are a bunch of words like that that once upon a time were part of a pair, and then, being disenfranchised is just something that would come up more than the idea. I mean, losing your vote. I don't know that there's any other way to say it. It's an idea that just comes up more than enfranchised. So that part, that half the pair just kind of fell out of use, disgruntled versus gruntled. I'm not entirely sure that gruntled has been part of the language for my guess is it sounds like Old English. Some of these things have been non-pairs for centuries and centuries. Hmm. And it's interesting to you learn these half pairs, and it doesn't occur to you until later, until you're a rather sophisticated user of English, that, oh, wait a minute, this is a negative and there's no positive. We learn it, and it just seems natural part of English, and we use the language that way. And then there are all these gaps.
Hmm. One of the more interesting things, what started us all talking about this here, is the kinds of words that are made up among family members to sort of express ideas. And one that I had heard in my own home over and over again, and then I found out that maybe she wasn't as clever as I thought she was ginormous. Mm-hmm. And my youngest, this was sort of something that is bigger than gigantic, but smaller than enormous.
Mm-hmm.
And gradually it became even larger than both. And it sort of slipped into our regular language, and it's one of those, it trips lovingly off the tongue, and it's got a great memory for the first time I heard it, and I can't let it go. I think it's part of me now.
Rita, this is a fascinating level of the language there, and we're heading into my word fugitives persona, mm-hmm. where I ask people to make up words to meet needs that have been expressed by other people. People say, gosh, shouldn't there be a word for something? So when I was researching my word fugitives book, I was looking for made up words of all kinds. Mm-hmm. There are words that people keep making up and using in their own families that just never make it into the regular language. And I find that amazing. Children coin rainbrella.
Right.
All the time. Mm-hmm. People will send me a postcard or a email saying, oh, here's this word that my four-year-old coined. And I'll think, your four-year-old and another 100 four-year-olds right. this year. But it's not to say that they don't actually coin that word. It's just, to me, it's amazing that a word keeps being coined and coined and coined as a really natural way of saying something. And it just never surfaces into official English.
Right. My other favorite one was we were at the zoo. And butterfly went by, and one of the children said, oh, it's a flutterby.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, wow, that actually describes it better than butterfly. But clearly, the people responsible for classifying insects wouldn't have thought so, or invertebrates, I should say, because I'm sure somebody will tell me, no, it's not an insect or something like that. But it's fun. Children are great for that.
Well, and if the listener who's a linguist was still on the line, it's fascinating to compare the language that children naturally create with the finished product.
Yes.
You can see that very early mm-hmm. regular verbs, they will know how to say... walked, walking. I guess the ings never change, but walk and walked. And then I eated.
Yes.
all the irregular ones mm-hmm. need to be learned individually. But you can see that pattern gets into children's brains really early. Mm-hmm. I mean, they coin eated not because they ever heard anybody say it, but just because they know the pattern.
It just makes sense to them. We have a caller on a cell phone on line number one. Welcome. Hello.
Hi. I actually have two questions. One of them is a phrasing that I never heard until I moved to the Midwest, but then I've started to hear it on national news broadcasts and stuff, and it's saying something, the one that comes to my mind is something needs washed, and I would have said needs to be washed, and I always thought it was incorrect, but then I've started to hear it all over the place with very well-spoken people using it. So that's my first question, is if there's any, you know, if there's any actual rule about that. And the other one is a little bit more of a story. My aunt had someone come and work for her, and she lives in North Carolina. And she was asking this woman what sort of job she wanted to take on. And she said, would you like to do this? And the woman said, well, I don't care to. And she went through a whole list, and she kept saying, I don't care to, I don't care to. And they got to the end, and my aunt said, well, what do you want to do? And the woman said, well, I thought I was fine with all of these. And to her, I don't care to means I don't care, that's fine. But it was completely the opposite
oh, wow.
of how most of us, when we heard the story, understood it. So I didn't know if you'd heard of mm-hmm. that phrase before, but apparently it's common in the South to use it to mean an acceptance of something instead of a rejection.
This so. One's new to me. I've heard I don't care without the to being used that way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm aware of that as a Southern regionalism, and that needs washed is a Midwestern regionalism. It is commonly used in some parts of the Midwest, and I don't know specifically where, and it's not standard English. If you were writing a business memo, you wouldn't put it that way. But what used to be regionalisms that people in a particular part of the country said something, you know, we're so mobile now that it's probably all over the Southwest, which is where so many people move to.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a little more economical of words than it needs to be washed. I wouldn't be surprised if it catches on rather widely, but it did start in your region.
Wow.
Okay.
That's interesting.
Hey,
thank you. We have a caller on line number 2 from Urbana.
Oh, hi. Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Oh, yeah. In talking, speaking about what you were just talking about, like the English say instead of in the hospital, they say in hospital.
In hospital, yeah.
So that could be the fact that I noticed that I had a friend that was from Mobile, Alabama, and would go down there, and I noticed that they would drop a lot of these, the ands and does, and all that kind of stuff, and they would just, you know, compress language, and I thought, well, maybe it's an English thing, you know, they came from. But I was going to ask you something about 10 years ago. I read a paper by a primatologist. It does tie into language. She had been studying some monkeys in Indonesia for like a year, and when she came back to the United States, she was sitting, you know, at a table in a public place looking over some paperwork, and she noticed people talking to each other. And because she had watched, you know, these primates for years, how they would groom each other, touch each other, and sort of, she thought to herself, language is a grooming tool between people, because she couldn't hear what they were saying. She just watched how they spoke and how they would, like, react facially to that. Have you seen that paper? Do you know anything about it?
No, that's...
Yeah, it's. I think I had a copy. I saw it online once, about a year ago, because I was looking for it. But it's a really interesting idea. And
I will Google language and grooming tool.
Yeah. But see, what I think is real interesting about it, though, is if you stop, ever since I've read that paper, because she just said it as an aside in this paper, I read a lot of this stuff. When I'm out in public, if I can't hear the conversation, I watch people's faces and how they use, you know, the words. It's really an interesting concept. Because it isn't so much when you're away, because, you know, when you hear someone speak, you listen to the content of what they say, or, you know, like if it's gossip or if it's serious or whatever. But I was wondering what you thought of that. But when I first started listening to you, I thought, oh, this is so dryly academic, you know, how they dissect things. And because when I was in graduate school and getting my doctorate, I was in art history, I had to take everything apart, you know, piece by piece, literally, and then reassemble it in some sort of form. But it really does have a purpose, and I do appreciate your work.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And thank you. You mentioned the word fugitive. There's a wonderful section in the middle on antiques and novelty items. And I was sort of looking at these the other evening, and there's a couple of wonderful things in here. Aqua Bob is an icicle. Is that real or made up? Beggar's velvet as the downy particles accumulating under furniture from the negligence of housemaids.
As in dust bunnies.
As in dust bunnies, yeah, right. We all know about those. And Benbel, any minor anomalies, sweater pills, for instance. And then some things like hibernacle, a winter retreat for a hibernating animal. And when I was going through some of these, clearly I couldn't even pronounce. I couldn't even get my tongue around them to figure out how somebody would have said them. But I was shocked at how many of them were actually real and how many of them were just suddenly they sprung up somewhere. And they were just novelty words that somebody had made up.
No, this is great to hear because that was exactly my purpose there. I was kind of messing with readers' mm-hmm. minds about, okay, so what is the difference between a real word and a made-up word? The words in that, it was a little quiz, the words that are, quote, real mm-hmm. have appeared in dictionaries. They're mostly not current words. They're not in current dictionaries, but at some point they were prevalent enough that somebody would bother to put them in a dictionary and define them. And I really think that it's almost impossible to tell some just invented words apart from some real words.
Mm-hmm.
So that's exactly what that little quiz was meant to do.
Well, we run a program here on WILL AM 580 on Sunday mornings, Says You, which is it's described as a game of wit and wordplay. And it's great fun to listen to them tease each other with, is this a real word? Is this the real definition of this real word? Give me a word for this. And we never guess right, you know, and I wish I could say occasionally that we did, but it seems like we never seem to manage that. But it's just wonderful fun because it's just people playing with words, like numbers puzzles. They're word puzzles without, you know, the frame around them in a crossword. And it's just an enjoyable program to listen to. And it drew me to the whole subject matter that we have a lot of words at our disposal. If we saw the Oxford English Dictionary or the Oxford Dictionary of the English Language, it's weighed in on big scales. It's not small. There's a lot of pages to that, and there are a lot of words on those pages, most of which we don't even bother to use anymore.
Well, and some of them we don't really need anymore. A hauberk and greaves is medieval knight's costume, and you can find those words in the dictionary, and it just doesn't come up.
Yeah, but not regularly.
But all kinds of things that are in our daily life, and that was the inspiration for word fugitive.
That word fugitive, by the way, if anyone hasn't actually picked it up, it's fun, and it's written in a way that's just enjoyable. It's a great read. Rustled up words, you know, words that are sort of 12 of one, a dozen of the other. Which dozen of the following words about words are from dictionaries and which dozen aren't? We sort of tend to think that, well, you know, if somebody says, well, it's in the dictionary, and they look at you with conviction, you go, well, okay. You know, maybe not. You know, and I also always wondered how many of those words that I learned to spell for spelling bees were created because a bunch of people were sitting around, a group of people were sitting around, they didn't have the right word for something, and it just kind of popped up like ginormous, and the next thing you know, there it is in a dictionary. And I always wondered if that ever happens, if that is something that has occurred.
As I understand it, dictionaries may have one or two made-up words to see whether the competition is cribbing from them. But that it doesn't really go beyond that.
Uh-huh.
I've seen lexicographers at work, and it's a almost scientific process at this point, where you sit there with a corpus, just tons of whatever kind of source you think your dictionary ought to use. And some use spoken language as well as printed sources, and some dictionaries insist that things have to have been in print before they'll put them in the dictionaries. Just tons of uses of a word on a screen, and the person looking at them goes through to make sure that the definitions that they've got cover all the uses.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've got some folks waiting to talk to you. Caller number one on line one is from Urbana.
Hello.
Hi, back again. Hi.
When you were talking about words that families use that don't ever make it out of the family, I was reminded of the word putter putt, which my mother used for passing gas.
And yeah.
That's kind of a polite one. That's
yeah.
And I can remember going to school and using that word and being made fun of because nobody else outside my family actually uses that word. Another one was, I was reading an article recently in The Nation about people who are doing the 100-mile diet, trying to buy all of their food within a 100-mile radius of their home. And the word that they used for those people was localvores, which I thought was interesting. And the phenomenon was localvorism. And I don't even know, it feels like you could say localvorism, with just a stress on the first syllable, or you could say local vorism with two stresses in the word. But anyway, I
like voyeurism.
Yeah. Well, it's like carnivore, omnivore, and you have local vore. So I thought that was pretty clever. Anyway, that's all.
That's what's known as a portmanteau word. Not that anybody uses the word portmanteau anymore, but it was coined by Lewis Carroll in Alice Through the Looking Glass to describe a word that takes bits of two other words, like local and omnivore, carnivore, mm-hmm-vore,
mm-hmm.
and puts them together, packs the two into one, and a portmanteau in Lewis Carroll's day was a suitcase that had two compartments in it.
Ah.
So that localvore is a portmanteau word, and most of the new coinages that are easy to understand are that way, because you've got that vore, so you know it's about eating,
mm-hmm.
and then local, eats locally grown food.
Huh. We have another caller on line number 2 in Oakland. Welcome.
Hello there.
Yes.
I have a family word, which I think may be catching on some. Anyway, it's flirred. Have you heard flirred?
No.
No. Well, it's spelled P-H-L-E-R-D. And you know when you're going to do the laundry and you're cleaning out pockets and you get everything out, and then there's this little residue of fuzzy, cruddy stuff that is still in the pocket. And everybody has flirred.
Oh, yeah. You see it frequently after you take the dark clothes out of the dryer.
Yeah, mm-hmm. there's that, too. Mm-hmm. And I know my whole family has adopted that one, so it's spread quite a ways anyway. My aunt, I think, is one that coined that one. Mm-hmm. And I had a word that I find annoying in the way a gentleman earlier was talking about words that are being overused or incorrectly used, and it's problematic.
Mm.
It seems like everything is problematic these days, and they're using it as if it means to cause a problem, and I don't believe that is the meaning of the word. It's problematic is questionable, not more like questionable rather than causing a problem. And everything, anything is difficult anymore, it's being called problematic. So I don't know, what do you think about that one?
I try to have as few opinions as possible. And I would like to look in, before I said anything about that, I'd like to look in a few dictionaries to see whether problematic has acquired that second use. I understand what you're saying about...
Yeah, I did look, and we have an unabridged, but it's not a real new one. And it seemed to be more on the track that I'm on, but I don't know, maybe they have managed to beat it into shape in another word.
Well, let's see here. I've got I've got 5 dictionaries on my computer, and I like the American Heritage a lot, not just because I'm on the usage panel, but because I think they really do care about how words ought to be used. They're a little less, this is how words are used, than some of the other dictionaries. And can you hear my computer saying problematic? definitions are posing a problem difficult to solve, open to doubt, debatable, not settled, unresolved, or dubious.
Uh-huh.
Posing a problem, difficult to solve, I think is the use that you don't like, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't think it was, I don't know, somehow it got into my head many years ago that problematic was more like a comparative situation. But perhaps it's really got the other meaning now, and I'll just have to get used to it.
Well, you don't have to say it that way if you don't like it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But knowing that it is in dictionaries and just saying, all right, well, they're not complete idiots if they say it.
Right. Okay, well, thank you. I've really enjoyed your show.
Okay, we have one last caller on line number 3, and we have to, it has to be a quick question. So line number 3 in Champaign?
Well, it's actually a couple of comments. For he or she, if I'm writing, and it's in the nominative case, I use /he for he or she, but you can't do it in spoken language. And oftentimes when we were talking about the problem with Michael Jordan went to lunch with
Tom Jones.
Tom Jones. He, Michael, told Tom he enjoyed his work or something like that. You use it as like a
More like a parenthetical?
Yeah, or like a predicate noun or something. Mm-hmm. And then I wanted to say that Quakers into the early and mid part of the 20th century, some Quakers were still using thee and thou, and that started when they arose in the 17th century because they wouldn't doff their hats, another old word, to their supposed betters, and they got thrown in prison a lot of times because they addressed the judges with the familiar. And one last, my daughter at 4 coined puzzent for shouldn't, isn't supposed to.
Oh.
Have you heard that before?
No.
Oh,
cute.
Well, that's a complicated one. Well, I want to thank our callers this morning and also my guest, Barbara Walriff, who's the senior editor of the back page of Word Court and Word Fugitives columnist for The Atlantic. And I really hope, Barbara, that we can call on you and have you come back again and again, because I think that there are a number of folks who would enjoy delving into this topic again.
Oh, I've got a whole list of subtopics. We should talk about dictionaries sometime, and we should talk about
absolutely
made-up words sometime, and we should talk about the rules and the serious part of language some other time.